everybody, and welcome back. This is another edition of the Brew University Book Club. It is season two, and we're talking about The Ideal Team Player by Pat Lencioni. So glad you can join us as we dissect this thing and get into all the nooks and crannies of what exactly it takes to make sure that you are hiring the right people, the ideal team players for your team. And with me, of course, as always, is my group of ideal team players, starting with our human resource director in Minnesota, Kara. Hi, Kara. How's it going?
Good. How are you, Jeff?
Good. Glad to have you with us this morning.
Happy to be here.
Also happy to have with us Nate Eisenhower, our delivery manager in Tampa. Hi, Nate.
Hi, how are you, Jeff? Happy holidays.
I'm doing well. Happy holidays and happy flamingo that Nate has for us as well. Also in Tampa is our C&G sales director, Joe Walczak. Good morning, Joe. How you doing?
Good morning. It's time to read to succeed, Jeff.
It's time to read to succeed. There's going to be a pizza party at the end of this for everybody that finishes all their chapters. It's going to be fantastic. Andrew Ferber will be at that pizza party with us. Hi, Andrew.
You bet. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, our sales manager in Minnesota. Glad to have you with us. And of course, Suzanne Borgia is with us as well, our HR director in Tampa. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning, Jeff. And good morning, bookies.
Good morning, bookies. That's what's happening. All right. With that, we are diving through the ideal team player. We've been talking so far about the fable that he put together, but now it's time to sort of shift gears and really dive deeper into the model itself. So we're going to be talking today about the model portion of the book, beginning with the three virtues of an ideal team player. And I think it's very apropos that as Lencioni kicks off this section, he starts by referencing Jim Collins, right person, right place, right time, because I think it's an equally good metaphor for understanding something that's kind of complicated in a simplistic way. But that's really at the core of what this whole model is about. It's about making sure that you've got the right person. And then, you know, Collins would say, make sure you've got them in the right place on the team at the right time. But this whole model, ideal team player, is really so focused in around right person. And this book starts with this section of the book starts with a challenge that I think is a good question to kick us off, which is, why does it seem that so many leaders want to hire for competency and skills while overlooking culture as a selection factor? So I'll ask my bookies, what do you guys think as we get into this? The virtues of an ideal team player, why is this something that we all seem to intrinsically understand and yet not have put at the forefront of our hiring for so long for so many people?
I'd say it's probably easier to identify skills and competency, and as far as the job, whether that's in sales and you have numbers to back up your performance or other metrics, but it's probably harder, I think, for managers and people that are conducting interviews to suss out, you know, humility and, you know, hungriness, if you will. So
I think that's an outstanding point, Andrew, is that you're right. It's pretty easy to see competencies and skills. It's often right there on the resume, right? We can look and see, have you done this kind of work before? Do you have relevant experience? Do you have the right credentialing? These things are very check the box and very easy to go down that list and see if this is someone who might fit the bill, as it were. But it is a lot harder to figure these things out when it comes to hiring. What else makes this such a challenge?
I think time, Jeff. We often get caught up in the idea that we need people right now. You know, we're a very fast-moving business. And so a lot of times it's just easier to say, okay, I need someone right now. I know they've got the technical skills. They've got the background. So, you know, they check a couple of the boxes and we're off to the races. Jim Cook always says with Boston Beer that you always hire a better person than the person that left, regardless of how long it takes. And I find that although that's the right idea and it's directly linked to this model, man, is that hard with time limits.
No, absolutely. Time crunch and situation always makes this more difficult. And that is one of, I think, the biggest challenges of staffing and hiring in general, is that it doesn't happen in a vacuum. You know, if we could do this in a perfect world, we would have all the time we want. We'd have all the candidates we need until we found the exact perfect one. But in the reality of it, every day that someone is out, every day that we're at a missing position is a day that someone else is having to do double work, or that we're having to cover it somehow in some way. And so it puts a burden on us that creates a sense of urgency. Unfortunately, the paradox of that situation is that same sense of urgency that causes us to rush into selecting someone can cause us to selecting the wrong person, which we'll have to get rid of. And then we'll have an opening and then we'll have to do it all over again. And again, it's that that horrible cycle of staffing that we're all so familiar with. When we don't have time to do it right, we end up having to make time to do it over and over. So I think that's a big part of the challenge. And I think that's part of why I like this book is, you know, we'll talk about this some more in a minute, but you know, the words, having words for something makes it easier to identify, makes it easier to select for. And up until now, these are things that we knew we wanted, but I don't know that we've always had words for them. And having words will make it easier and I think speed up that process ultimately, but it is definitely a limiting factor on the front end. So I want to go back to something I talked about a little bit previously, and that's my real estate metaphor when it comes to hiring employees. I want to see what you guys think with this. I believe that when it comes to hiring employees, it's a lot like investing in real estate for two reasons. One, you make your money at the buy, and second, location matters most. So what does that mean? Well, when it comes to making your money at the buy, in real estate, it's all about how turnkey the property is. If you find the perfect home, that's nearly impossible. You're never going to find something that has everything you want because so much of it is a matter of taste. And so you quickly learn when you're in the real estate market, and more people have probably bought their first house or found an apartment than have ever had to hire someone before. So this is a metaphor that works, especially for younger or newer managers who maybe have not yet been in the hiring seat, but have, you know, had to go out and find that first apartment. You know, some things are easy to fix, right? You can throw new paint on the walls pretty quick. You can get new carpeting down. You can even change the landscaping relatively easily. Remodels take more time, right? And more investment. So, I mean, if you want, you can really take a place all the way down to the studs and start over. But of course, that's going to be super expensive and very time consuming, still, however, doable. How much investment you have to put into a property depends on what you get at the buy. The more you can get, the less you'll have to invest. The less you can get, the more compromises you have to make, the more you'll have to invest both in time and money. But at the same time, there's one thing that, you know, when it comes to real estate, what people always say, location, location, location. And that's because it's the one attribute of a real estate deal you can't change. I can't turn that property that is midtown into beachfront, right? There's only one place it can actually be. Everything else, I can absolutely change it. Like I said, take it down to the studs, strip the foundation out of the ground and start over. But if I get a bad location, there is nothing I can do about that. And when it comes to hiring, I think those metaphors pull across in an interesting way because you can train a lot. Training and development can do a lot. We've had merchandisers become draft line cleaners or even CDL drivers. We've had clerical team members who got their degrees and turned into IT technicians for us. You know, our president in Florida started out as a driver on a truck. Skills, knowledge, time, training, if you're willing to invest the money and the time, you can get a lot changed and in developed and built in talent. But what you can't do is you can't make someone first choice who's not first choice. There is a certain locational aspect. And for us, that's culture. For us, that's, you know, and that's what I think Lencioni is talking about with these three virtues is to say, here are three things that if you get them wrong, it's like buying a house at the end of the runway of the big airport in town. You are never going to make that place better. There are always going to be problems with low flying jets and noise and everything else because you can't pick that piece of property up and move it somewhere else. And similarly, I think when it comes to people, if we don't understand the things we can't train and develop and fix, then we're making the wrong decisions at hiring because those are the things we can't train or develop or fix. And there's a lot we can. Training and development can do a lot, but there are some non-negotiables in it. So what do you guys think about that as a metaphor and a model? And what do you think are some of the things? I know, obviously, you know, the model, but for us here at JJ Taylor, what would we sort of define as that stuff we can't fix? What's the location that we have to get right?
I think you hit it on the head, Jeff. It's culture. It's Suzanne said it in our last session. We're in the people business. And it has to start with that very foundation, first choice culture. And if we can't hit that right, if you just don't fit that culture, we could train you all we want on the technical side and you may be an all-star at doing certain things within the business, but you're not going to fit with the group. And it's a people business. You got to fit with the group.
I think our other non-negotiable, it's a people business, but it's hard work. You know, I mean, people talk about generational differences and laziness and all of that, but all of our positions are hard work. Warehouse, delivery, sales. I mean, we're moving heavy product. So it's we have to find somebody that is able to, you know, safely move that product.
Absolutely. And not just physically able, but it's that stamina, it's that mentally able, that willingness to I don't mind picking up 600 cases and moving them, you know, throughout the day, or, you know, having to do repetitive work over and over again. That's both physically demanding and that takes a certain mentality. That's a different mindset than a lot of people necessarily have. And someone who's going to not enjoy that type of detail oriented, repetitive type stuff, they're going to burn out fast around here. And there's nothing we can do to fix that because we can't change the nature of the business. Yep. I think that's another big one. What else? What are some of those other, if we really took it down to that kind of, I like this level of detail where it's like, what are some of the things that are really for us in this realm of can't be fixed, can't be changed?
I always find in sales, Jeff, that I say people, we need to hire people who can manage themselves, who are good at being independent. And it's a non-negotiable for me if you need so much structure that you can't operate on your own. You know, in sales, you're out there on your own. It's repetitive. You go to the, you know, you hit your accounts, you do your job. So if we have somebody who isn't able to self-motivate, it falls apart before it starts.
Yep, absolutely. It's they've got to be able to work without supervision because we can't supervise them all day long. Absolutely true.
That's the same thing in delivery. I mean, that's probably the biggest thing because it the small things in delivery, just filling the shelves and doing these things, if you don't want to do it, it's so easy to skip those steps, but causes a huge, huge problem.
Absolutely. Any other thoughts on some of the stuff that we know we need to be looking for, but can't be found on the resume?
I think the hungriness factor, I mean, the smart, the people skills and stuff like that, the emotional intelligence that we've talked about, I think that can be almost taught a little bit more than having that innate drive to succeed and have that work ethic to work hard. So I think that's important as far as, you know, attributes that we need to identify in the right candidates.
Nope, absolutely. I agree. I think everything we've been talking about here could be rolled up underneath one of these three, right? Humble, hungry, smart. They all sort of fit. And that's the brilliance of this model, is that even as we go through each one of these and we'll talk in depth about what they are and how they fit to us, at the end of the day, what seems to work so well about this, and he talks a little bit about the history of the model and how it came to be and how it started as sort of their own internal metrics. And then they would share it with clients, and then their clients would be like, yeah, we're doing those too. And they're like, hey, well, you can't steal our culture. And he's like, we're not trying to steal your culture. You've tapped into something so innate, so perfectly suited. As I say, it's sort of the unspoken assumption of five dysfunctions is that every member of the team, in order to be functional, has to meet this model. And so humble, hungry, smart, I think really is, it's the real estate equivalent of location. If you don't get these three right, there's very little you can do to fix them. These are not things that are easily trained or coached or developed. If you don't get a base level, you're never going to get what you want out of an employee. And again, like real estate, the more of these three things you can get, the more turnkey your property is going to be. And we can do so much more. You know, we can train, we can develop, we can teach people beer, we can teach people how to sell, we can teach people how to deliver, we can teach people how to drive, we can teach them how to clean a draft line or fix a machine or become a mechanic, but we can't teach them how to be humble, hungry, and smart. Certainly not easily. We can only develop what's already there in the foundation. And so if we don't get that right, if we buy in a bad location, we're never going to get our values worth. And if we hire somebody without these attributes, we're never going to get what we want out of an employee. We're going to have to turn them over. And that's, I think, the shift that this whole book presents to us, is this idea of we've spent all this time looking at resumes, looking at qualifications and competencies and what's there. But that was the easy stuff. That was the stuff we could have easily fixed if we had to. It's like buying a house because we like the paint color and the carpets that are in it, paying no attention to how good is the wiring and does the plumbing work and does the drain field have to be fixed? Because if any of those are wrong, it's going to be super expensive and very time consuming to fix it. And same here, if we hire somebody that, you know, oh, look at this renovated kitchen, it looks so beautiful. If we hire somebody that, oh, they've got all the qualifications, they meet all the lists, but they're failing on humble, hungry, or smart, we're going to have a very expensive mess on our hands trying to get that sorted out. So let's dive into these three in real good depth here, because this is the part of the book in the model where he really starts talking about how they define these. And he doesn't spend a lot of time on defining them, but I think, it's because the simplicity of this model, the almost, I want to say, intuitiveness of this model makes it hard to put in a generic sense into a lot of words. But in our sense, in our personal sense, I think there's a lot we can talk about here. So let's start with humble. Humble is the first part of the model that he talks about. And he says it's probably the easiest to understand because it's exactly what you think it is. It's being humble. It's having humility. But I always like to think in examples. So what do you guys have as far as if somebody was trying to identify Humble, what are some real life examples of people you've worked with, people you've hired, people you know that fit this bill, and how would a manager go about identifying this in someone if they were trying to select for this vector?
I mean, I think this is, you know, we talked last time about our leadership and how approachable they are, and you know, J. Martin walking the tunnel. I've been out in the warehouse before and a glass broke, and it would have been easy for Mike Hampton to be like, hey guy, go clean that up. But Mike Hampton went and get the mop and the, you know, the broom and cleaned it up. So, I mean, I think it's that being prepared to do what your team is doing. And I just really think that approachability is important too. And our leadership definitely has it.
I agree, Susanna. I think approachability is a great real life example of Humble in action. Somebody who that doesn't have that air appearance of importance, of self-importance, of you're not worth my time or you're not worth my attention. Someone who you can really easily just connect with and who shows genuine interest in other people, I think is a great example of Humble in action. I like the quote, in fact, that he had mentioned from C.S. Lewis that humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. And I think that approachability factor fits right in, is that these are people who are more interested in others than they are themselves. And that is something I think that you can see right away, is when you first introduce yourself to someone, when you start talking to someone, are they more interested in telling themselves about you, or are they more interested in learning about you and other things?
Jeff, I used to work for Walgreens, and I was in their management training program. And part of the program is you bounce around to a lot of different stores. And what was unique about that is you get to deal with a lot of different store managers and personalities. The very first store I was at had a manager named Dave, and he was just a jackass, to put it from the book. I mean, and I didn't know any better. You know, I'm just out of school, and this is kind of my first real big gig. And by the time I made it to my third store, I got to a manager named Margaret Masters, who really put herself directly, immersed herself with the team. Nothing was about just her. Complete opposite of Dave. Dave took the credit for his store. It was his store. Don't embarrass him. Make him look good were the rules. Whereas Margaret was, it's our store. You know, we need to succeed. Gave all the credit when our DM would come in for a visit. If it was a good visit, she was giving everything to the employees because it was a group. And she really did drive that culture. And it was such a difference between Dave and Margaret that when I was with Dave, I'm thinking, what mistake did I make getting into this company? And then by the time I left Margaret, it was, I can do this. I can make this work. I'm excited to make this work. I'm excited to go run my own team. So it makes a big difference when somebody is humble enough to pass the credit around collectively.
I like to say one of the ways I know somebody's got the right level of humble is when they talk about we instead of I. And you hear that even in an interview, you can hear that. If you start asking them about what they, you know, what they've done, and you know, of course we use behavioral interviewing and it's all about past experiences and past examples. When I hear them always start with, well, this is what we were doing, or this is what was going on, or the team was focused on this, that's a good place to start to know that there's a sense of humility and humbleness in there. Now I may have to, you know, probe into that to get to the specifics of, well, what did you contribute to that? But if their default setting is to tell me what the team accomplished or to put it in those terms, when you hear somebody talk about what we're doing, not what I'm doing, that's always a big, to me, big green flag that this is someone who's got the right kind of humility, because they just think that way. They think about whatever I'm accomplishing, it's accomplishing it as part of the greater whole, and we're getting it done. It doesn't matter that I personally did it, we did it. And so I've seen that in a handful of people over the years, and it's always a good sign of a good amount of humility involved. It's a great one. What else?
I think for me on the sales side of the business, some of my strongest performers don't toot their own horn, almost to a fault sometimes. So it's weird because I'm trying to almost try to coach them to be like, hey, what are you, they're getting their stuff done. They're scoring really high on their MBOs. They're performing at a high level, but they don't necessarily go out of the way to recognize or be recognized, I guess. And a lot of times, so there's a little bit of a conflict there, because I want them to be like proud of their work and show me what you're doing, like send pictures of nice displays you sold in and merchandise or whatever. And yet they just nose down, get the job done. So I think that maybe it goes back to culture too. We want to kind of show, I guess, other reps in the sales organization that these are successful examples of displays or whatever, but we don't want the reps to be too, you know, bragging about their successes and whatnot. So it's one that I struggle with a little bit, I think, as a manager, as far as how to handle that. But for the most part, I think the reps that, like I said, are not really that vocal and loud, they're the ones that are really the ones that are getting the work done and driving it, and that we probably need the least amount of work on my end.
It's a great point, Andrew. And he actually talks about that there are two types of people who fall outside the humility or humble factor. One being obvious, and that's the ego-driven type, which is really easy to see because they can be poisonous. They'll sacrifice everything. They make it about them and their success. They're not worried about the team. It's me, it's my, it's I. You know, like Joe was talking about with Dave, his, you know, former example of, you know, just everything's about me. Don't embarrass me. This is my success. And whatever you guys accomplish, I'll be the one standing up, taking the credit for it. We see those, and I think they are the easiest examples of someone who lacks the humble factor. But he also talks about the ones who lack humble because they're lacking in self-confidence, and that these are less obvious because they can appear to be generous. They can appear to be like they're part of the team and you know, just straight up team players. But that long-term, there is a detrimental factor there because they oftentimes are avoiding conflict. They're avoiding standing up and realizing their contributions. And I think to what you're even talking about here, Andrew, is here you've got great performers that if they don't recognize in themselves that, you know, if I stand up and show my work, I'm creating a positive example for the team. They don't have the enough of that generosity to realize that what they're doing is good for others, even though it means putting the spotlight on them. That can be a weak link factor. And it's, you know, the work's getting done, yes, but is it really helping the team grow? Not as much as it could. So I think that's a really good call out because Lencioni talks about that you want people who are humble enough to not be about themselves, but still generous enough to understand that it's not about taking credit. It's about helping others grow and see what's out there and what's possible. It's that tough line. But what do you guys think? I thought that was an interesting point that he talked about in that balance and how this has a tipping point.
I agree, Jeff. We sell to so many different demographics that and the business moves so quickly with new SKUs and new suppliers and new products that it can be a detriment if we don't know what's working well in somebody's area versus another person's area. And so if somebody isn't, in this case, humble enough to say, hey, look what I've done. This is working really well. That we could be holding back a number of other sales reps. They might not have the knowledge to know that that product or idea is working.
Yeah, there's almost a, it may not be motivated by selfishness, but there is a selfishness when our team doesn't communicate and share with each other. Because great ideas aren't making it around, because someone who's got a winning formula, if they're not taking enough credit for that formula, at least enough to say, hey, everybody, I want you to be aware that this is a thing that I'm doing and it's working, then we're holding everybody else back, not by pulling them back, but by simply not giving them what they need to propel forward. It's a really interesting different a take on humble, but I think it's an important part. What are some other things that you guys see that are obvious examples of this is humble in action that you could listen for in an interview? Maybe not directly, but you don't necessarily have to ask the question, are you humble enough? I don't think anybody's going to answer that directly in an interview, but what are some things you guys listen for or look for when you're evaluating someone and to say, this shows me that there's a humbleness to them?
One of my favorite interview questions, and it's kind of a funny one, but tell me about a time when you made an error and how you fixed it, you know, and really in that one, I always listen for, did they own up to it? And I think that's definitely part of humble is being able to say I messed up and, you know, maybe there is a better way to do things. So I think people sometimes are taken aback why we're asking that question, but I think the answer is always really important.
Yeah, I agree. I like that question a lot in the interview. Also, if you've ever been coached or counseled or written up, because I mean, we've all had some sort of coaching, like you can't give an answer to that. It's like, are you just not aware of what you're doing? Or do you just think that you're so great? Like, I've never done anything wrong. That's the great, the best answer is when someone smiles, says, I've never been coached. Like, really? Okay. That doesn't make any sense. Also, like, not just in the interview thing, I find with training, because my team leads and other drivers do a lot of training with a new driver. So you'll get them out in the trade and you'll show them how to stack a lay down.
Is that from the blade or from the handle, Nate?
Well, you're pushing from the handle. So I like to start there. But that's the point that I'm making is I find some of the trainers, they'll say, you have to do it this way. Instead of showing a guy that this is the way that I do it, now you stack it and see, because maybe this guy who's never stacked a lay down will show you something you've never known. But that takes humility to learn something from somebody else. So you see it in a lot of different aspects.
I love that point, Nate, because I couldn't agree with you more. I think humility is such an important aspect for whether or not someone is going to be trainable. The act of learning is an inherently vulnerable act. We have to admit we don't know something. We have to be willing to let someone else be smarter than us. And people without humility are untrainable. If you really think you know it all, you've got it all, I don't need to be taught, I don't need to be told, I've got this, it's mine, it's under control. Those people are not going to be teachable, coachable, or improvable. And so I think that's a really, really great point about the importance of humble. And I think going back to how do we identify it, that's a great way to suss that out is if you get somebody who, in talking to them and hearing about their past experiences, doesn't seem to ask enough questions, doesn't seem to have taken any feedback or realized that they were given feedback, because I think you're right. I think everybody's been given feedback, whether you realized you were being coached or not is the better question. That shows a real lack of that humility that is so essential for being able to coach and develop somebody in the way we want them, because, you know, that's part of the job, part of every company's job to assimilate their culture and perpetuate their culture is to train people into it. You got to learn our language. You got to learn our way of doing things. You got to learn the nuances that make us us. And people who are lacking in humble will not easily take to new ideas or be willing to be told how to do stuff. So I think that's a really great point.
I think another great interview question when trying to suss out if a candidate has humility, is asking them, you know, tell me about an area that you can develop in. If somebody is saying, I can't think of one, you know, it's like, we all have areas of development. And I feel like that's a great interview question to try to see what they would say, you know, are they humble enough to admit that there's an area for development?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If they don't know what they're working on, that means they're probably not working on anything. And if they don't know where their opportunities are, they've got too much ego getting in the way of being able to identify and have that self-awareness. And again, that's going to make them hard to train. That's going to make them hard to deal with. And I think that's such a great, simple question. And what's funny about all these questions, I think in particular with the one you just mentioned, Kara, is we ask that question. We all know that we need to ask that question, but I think a lot of managers get hung up on, then I'm listening for what are they saying so I know what I have to work on, not what are they saying because I want to see if they even have an answer. And that's what's so interesting about this part of the discussion to me is looking at these questions that we're used to asking, but in whole new ways, right? When we ask, where are your opportunities? What are you working on? If you're listening for, if they say communication, I got to know what I'm buying, you're missing the point. The real point is to listen for, do they have the humility to know the answer? And also, what are you going to have to work on with them? But there's a question under the question. And similarly to, have you ever been coached? Or, you know, or what was the last thing you were coached on? Some managers are asking that question and they're listening for, what kind of problems can I expect to encounter? But what they really should be listening for first is, does this person have self-awareness? Is there a humility there that I can work from? Because again, these questions, if we leave ourselves at the level of competency and skills, we're missing the layer that can really come out through these questions, which is, you know, is this humility, this humbleness that we want there?
I was just going to say to that point, I think another piece of humility is being able to look at someone else's strengths and how they, you know, counterbalance you as the leader of the team. And, you know, these three characteristics are so important in building a team. So I think being humble enough to say, you know, that person has terrible communication skills. Well, maybe you already have someone on the team that's your communicator. You know, I mean, you really need to balance those out with your entire team. I don't want a bunch of me's in HR. You know, I think we have a great balance of a team that people feel comfortable coming to about certain areas.
Oh, what a great point, Suzanne, because that you're right. There is now we're two levels deep down. This is an inception of the interviewing purposes. Do you as the interviewer have the humility to know what you need and bring the right people on board? What a great, great point. Couldn't agree more. I think it does take humility to conduct a good interview and realize that you might be bringing somebody on that they may be, you know, hopefully if you're doing right, do you have the humility to hire somebody that's more talented than you, that knows more than you do, that's better at it than you? Because I've seen a lot of leaders who don't want to bring on someone who's a threat, right? And I don't want somebody that could outshine me or be coming after my job. I need somebody that's going to do their part of the stuff and not be gunning for my position. It takes humility to be the kind of leader that goes, oh, this person's coming for my job. And that's good because I plan on moving out of this and into something better of myself someday. So I need somebody to back me up and be ready to take this on. But that in and of itself is a lesson in humility and humble. So I'll give you two more that I think are interesting little examples. You guys can tell me if you've got any thoughts on these. One is I always try to listen for, again, are they sharing credit for their accomplishments when they talk about the things that they've done? If everything, and it's a tough balance in an interview because they know they have to sell themselves. But I'm always trying to listen for, are they selling themselves along with other people? Are they sharing in the accomplishments and talking about that? And I think we've talked that one through. But the other one is, do they talk about big pictures and team goals? And do they have an awareness of things that are bigger than just themselves? What is the team working on? You know, what's the bigger goal that we're chasing that's not just my day-to-day execution, my monthly MBOs? What are we focused on as a group that is bigger than just me? And I think people who can articulate that have that right level of humble because they're aware of the world beyond themselves. And I think when you get somebody that is completely focused in on this is what I'm doing, this is all what I've got going on, this is my little world, it may not be pure ego driven, but again, there's sort of that insulated factor of they're just not aware enough that they're a part of something bigger than themselves. There's a lack of humility or a lack of humble in that from my experience. What do you guys think? You ever encounter anybody with those sorts of problems?
I thought this was an interesting, I mean, I had mixed feelings about this when he was talking about it in the book, just from being in so many frontline interviews. I think we definitely do a good job about asking those questions and listening for that in management positions. I don't know that we do that a lot in your frontline warehouse team member, merchandiser, driver.
Why not?
I don't know. I mean, I think we're so focused on filling that spot and finding someone who perhaps has some experience and can hit the ground running. And, you know, we see the bigger picture of how important it is for all those teams to work together. And, you know, the beer doesn't get out without the warehouse or the merchandisers or the drivers or the sales reps. But I think those people just coming in our door who are perhaps newer in work life, they don't automatically see that. So they're definitely not giving us that. But I mean, he did give some good prompting additional questions we could ask. So yeah, I just had mixed feelings about it.
I did too. I'll be honest. When I saw this, I did too. And one of the things that I sort of landed on is, and I think this is where we see this book and Five Dysfunctions are so deeply intertwined, right? To the point where you almost kind of have to see them together. And I don't know that my metaphor for this is always, it's like the engine and the steering wheel of your car. You can't really even say which one's more important. They're kind of useless without each other. And Five Dysfunctions and Ideal Team Player, to me, have that balance. They're almost useless without each other. So this is one of those places where I think there's some crossover into the idea that in order for people to have a sense of something bigger than themselves, the team has to also have that sense. And so oftentimes you'll find people who don't have a sense of what's going on bigger than themselves. It's because the team has not created its thematic goal. It's because the team doesn't give them a higher purpose. It's because the company does not give them something greater to aspire to. If you haven't, as a leader, laid down what is our big picture, you really can't expect anybody else to understand it or be able to articulate it. So I think sometimes, and Suzanne, I hope this is sort of tying into where you were going, because it's kind of where my brain went, was I think sometimes we forget how important those positions can be to our bigger picture, and we don't do a good job as leaders of putting them in that context for them and testing to see then whether they can accept that or not. Because I agree, I don't think it's incumbent upon them to know what the bigger picture is, right? If I'm a merchandiser, if I'm a sales rep, if I'm a driver, if I'm a frontline operator, it's not my place to set the bigger picture, but I should know what it is. But if no one above me has taken the time to set a bigger picture, I sure as heck can't be expected to understand or be a part of it. And so there's an assumption, there's an unspoken assumption in, do they see the bigger picture, which is there a bigger picture to see? So I think as leaders, we have to understand that ourselves. How does a merchandiser contribute to a first choice experience for our customers? If we can't articulate that, I sure as heck can't expect them to articulate that. But if we keep that in mind and look at, we're trying to create a holistic customer experience that is the trusted beer advisor, that is the first choice relationship, then I can sort of say, okay, I understand, how does a merchandiser or a driver or a rep contribute to that? But what I'm looking for then too is people who understand that the relationship between an account and the company is made up of all the people who interact, and that they are one third of whether or not we are the trusted beer advisor in an account. It's not just whether they are or not. If they and the driver and the merchandiser have great relationships, the company has a great relationship. And if any one of those three falter, it's going to affect that relationship in a bigger way. And so they need to see that, but we have to lay it out for them first. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's a great point. And I think the manager emulating that is important to their team, and also shows their humility to say, hey, just because I'm the sales manager, you know, sales isn't everything. Our beer wouldn't get there without the delivery team. It wouldn't get loaded at night without those warehouse guys. So I think it's important for the leadership to emulate that as much as telling their team.
I agree. And I think that, much to your point, Suzanne, I do feel like it's a little harder hiring frontline workers than it is, you know, promoting into management, because we're asking similar questions, but it's the difference between having the work experience and not. And so I think what I got from the book was to dig a little deeper and not always needing a specific work example. If somebody doesn't have it, but you want to suss out humble, you know, ask about whether they were on a sport, you know, were you a part of a team? How do you interact with your friends and family? There's other ways to dig about it. And that was kind of my takeaway from shifting for someone who doesn't necessarily have the work experience, or maybe just the trade experience that we're looking for, to be able to suss out, okay, do they have the character trait? Because it can be difficult on those frontline positions.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've done a lot of frontline interviews over the past many years. So it can get difficult, but I try to just look for the people who walk in there and are interested, or maybe have questions, even if it's like, seems like the dumb question, because my number one goal is just to have a conversation. Like, I'll start off with just trying to talk to the person to get them comfortable. And I also like when I make a mistake or something or stumble, and then I point it out on myself. So it makes the person feel more comfortable that, hey, this guy's, you know, he's not stuck up. It makes them more relaxed. And I feel like I get better results. You're never going to be perfect, obviously. But I feel like I've had a pretty good track record of hiring some pretty decent people. And then I think that's the number one thing I look for, just the people that are just willing and anxious, or, you know, why are you here? What brings you to JJ Taylor?
And I think that's a perfect opportunity to transition into our next phase, which is the hungry, right? And the next thing that we're looking for, which is exactly that. Those people that are, why are they here? What's your drive? What's got you up and running in the morning? That's where hungry really comes from. I like the phrase, hungry people are always looking for more, when Lencioni first talks about hungry, he mentions hungry people are always looking for more. And I think that describes this attribute so well, whether it's in their work life, their personal life, whether it's in the successes of, you know, I want to sell more, I want to learn more, I want to grow more, I want to, you know, there's a lot of ways that that can manifest. But hungry people are looking for more is, I think, such a great way to sort of start that conversation. So I'll ask the same sort of question. What are some things that you guys look for to identify and find hunger in your potential new hires?
I've had, for example, I've had, you know, driver interviews. They come in and we're having a discussion and it comes up like, well, what are you looking to do? Or they say, how can you move up in the company? And so in the past, I've had other managers doing interviews would bring up, say, well, I don't know if I want to hire this guy to be a driver because he's just really interested in sales. And like, I think that's, you're looking at it the wrong way because he's coming in. Now you're learning different angles. It doesn't matter if his ultimate goal is to get into sales or run the company or whatever. We're hiring good people that want to, you know, help the team. That's the whole point. Like you're looking at it the wrong way. That's a hungry person to, because you don't, we can't have everybody that's going to stay on a truck for 30 years. I mean, then we're, you're going to have a few, but not 89 drivers that are just going to sit on the truck. Then we're just going to be stuck here. So I think that's a good example of hungry is just looking for what they can do within the organization to stay driven.
I also like to identify what have they done in the past by asking them, you know, tell me about a goal that you've met. And sometimes they have set a goal and they haven't met that goal, you know? And so that kind of, that raises a red flag. It's like, why, what, where did you lose your drive? You know, or you looking at someone's resume and seeing if what kind of education they have. And, you know, did they set the goal to get their 2-year degree or their 4-year degree, you know, and that kind of drive and motivation is something that I typically will look for.
Yeah. I talked about this in our first session, but I love the question about tell me a time when you went above and beyond what was asked of you and like, be as specific as possible. And I'm always looking for the situation where they went out of their way to do something extra to really wow a customer or an employee or anything like that. So that question usually ends up and getting thrown in there somehow in the interview template. But to Nate's point too, I've had drivers call our reps and be like, hey, why doesn't this account have this product? Like, let's sell this in. I mean, I love it when I see drivers and sales reps working together to get stuff done, whether it's a display or a new placement. And I mean, we have a handful of drivers and they've been around for a while, but they still have that drive and they're able to work with our guys to like help them out and work together. And it's helping the driver get more cases on the truck. So I love when there's that relationship, the teamwork, where they're working together to help each other out.
Yeah, that's the ultimate goal. I mean, I have a lot of new hires and they'll call me and say, well, why? I don't know where this goes. I'm like, well, why are you calling me? Because I have no idea either. You should be calling your salesman because he was the one that ordered it. Like you need to build a relationship and that's going to help us. Every one of the best drivers, you know, supposedly are the ones that have the best relationships with their sales rep. It's like when I was a driver, Michael Hensley was my sales rep. We had a great relationship. It's just what you build on. You're a team. You're that smaller idea of a team in the trade. Me and my salesmen, these are our accounts. We're going to be the best team in here. And then it's just going to go up from there.
Yeah. I think one way you can identify hungry is the willingness or the desire to have more or better relationships. And I think that's something you guys are alluding to in here that I think is really a smart aspect of identifying that. Is this someone who is constantly looking, how can I improve this relationship? Not just with the account, but with the people on other teams, you know, in any vector that gets me more success, I'm willing to chase after. And if it means getting better relationships built, I'm going to focus on that. And I'm going to make sure I'm constantly having the best relationships, both internally and externally, is another great example of hungry. Because again, it's that hungry people are always looking for more connections, more relationship building, more conversations and more knowledge, all are coming through in that. What else?
I think I love to ask what motivates you to do your job well every day. And you get it's vague, and it's vague on purpose because you get this large variety of answers. And I always like to look out for people who say, well, I want to do the best I can at my job because I want to make, you know, the most money I can make so I can continue on with my windsurfing hobby. And, you know, I love windsurfing and I'm the best windsurfer there is. And I go extreme and I won all these competitions, and they get on a roll and you realize they are hungry. You know, they're hungry. They're just not hungry about the job really in the right way. And so, you know, that can be a red flag that, you know, illustrates hunger, but it just might not be hunger in the right way we want to see it.
Absolutely. And Lencioni talks about how this is actually one, and I appreciate that he calls this out, this has a tipping point. There is a point at which too hungry becomes a problem, or hungry about the wrong things becomes the problem. Because again, if their hunger is completely around their own agenda, then yeah, they've got a lot of hungry, but they're going to lack the humility that they need in that balance to be right. And so there's a tipping point to this one where they just become so focused and so goals driven. And I appreciate him pointing that out, because I think we tend to think, especially in these key characteristics, oh, there's no such thing as no such thing as too much of a good thing. In this case, I think there can be. I think people can be too hungry, and that there's a place where this becomes a stumbling point as opposed to a propellant.
I think hungry is another example where sometimes you've got to take the person out of the meeting room and get some real life examples and look how they operate in the trade, because you know, depending on the questions asked, you can project hunger pretty easily. I mean, you want to look hungry in an interview. I think everybody knows that. You know, you want to project a sense of, I love to get things done, I like to be a winner. So I think this is one where it's really important to slow down and test those answers live in the trade to see what you get.
Yeah, I agree, Joe. I think this is probably the easiest one to fake, and the one that people are most likely to fake coming into an interview in particular. I think everybody coming into an interview, there's an inherent hunger that puts us in an interview in the first place. We obviously want something different or more, or we're, you know, literally starving and don't have a job and need something. And so there's a hunger by nature of it. And therefore it's one that we like to pump up big when we're coming into this. And I really want to show that I'm in it. I want this. That go-getter mentality. Stamina plays a lot into hunger, and it's easy to see them sprint through the interview, but can they sustain that hunger over a long period of time is much, much trickier to suss out. And I think you're right. You got to get creative if you're going to find out, is this temporary hunger? And the minute they get the job, that hunger has been satiated and they're going to, you know, find a hammock to lay in? Or is this someone who genuinely has a drive that every day they're going to get up and they're going to get out in the trade and they're going to get the work done because they like doing work? That's a tough thing to figure out. All right. So we've talked about humble. We've talked about hungry. Let's talk about smart, which I think is the toughest one to talk about because it's the one where the word that he's chosen is the most difficult to understand because it's just not an intuitive description. I almost, this is probably my least favorite of the three words because it requires so much explaining to get to where he's really trying to be. You know, this, he defines this as common sense about people, the ability to be interpersonally aware and appropriate. But I want to go back to something Suzanne and I have talked about many times over the years, because even before this book was a book, Suzanne and I used to discuss that there are really three things you need to do around J.J. Taylor to be successful. Show up, do your work, and be likable. And if you get at least two out of those three right, you're going to be fine. And if you get down to about one out of three, that's when we could expect people to start getting fired. But three out of three is a home run. And when it comes up to, you know, comes to that, show up, do your work, be likable. And again, this is long before this book was around for us to articulate. I think showing up is humble, you know, just the willingness to be there and be a part of it and get things done. I think doing your work is that hungry of just, I want to come in and I want to continually get new things done and be successful. And smart is what we sort of would have referred to as just being likable, just someone that people like to have around. And I think that's what he's really alluding to. I think, you know, smart is his word, but if it helps you to think of it as just, this is likability. This is having the interpersonal skills to be someone that people enjoy keeping around. Likable, smart is a really important part of the equation, but I think it's also one of the more dangerous ones. So let's see what you guys think. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on smart, how he defines it and what you think about it and how we look for it.
Smart is my favorite. I think it's probably, I mean, again, coming from an HR perspective, I think it's one of the most important. If I were ranking the three of these, I think smart is most important. I constantly am thinking, there's so many examples in work, and then I take it to my home, to my kids. How do I make my kid not like that person I dealt with today? So I think smarts is one that I really want to teach my children how to handle people and deal with people and read people.
That's funny that you say that, Suzanne, because I thought the same thing. This is my favorite one. The asking the good questions, you know, just being inquisitive. And if you don't understand something, keep asking the questions. Keep asking those good questions, you know, until you do understand. And being in HR, and I'm sure Suzanne can relate, is just listening to other people. Because 9 times out of 10, people just want to vent about something, right? And so they come to HR, they go to their manager, and being a good listener, I feel, is a key component to building that culture as well. And then staying engaged while you're listening. I think that's important for a lot of the employees to know that they have somebody that they can go to that can listen, that will listen to them.
I think this is one where I find it important to go with my gut. When I'm hiring for a position, these are people that are going to work directly with my team. They're a teammate now. And so if something just throws me off in an interview, if something doesn't feel right, if I feel like you're missing the mark or not able to mesh with our culture, regardless of what you said in the questions, I'm probably not going to be able to bring you in, because you have to mesh with the team. And if I feel like you're missing, and that wasn't defined for me before, and I think that's why I like smart, because now I have kind of a definition for it. You've got to have that, you know, je ne sais quoi. You got to have that ability to talk with people and mesh. And if you don't have it, it's not going to work for me.
If there was anyone who was going to be the first to drop French on one of my podcasts, it was going to be Joe, by the way. I knew it would happen eventually, and I'm not at all surprised that it was Joe. Andrew?
I was just going to reiterate what Joe says. I mean, it's for me the easiest of the three virtues to identify, especially in an interview. I mean, those first 5 minutes you sit down with a candidate, you know, small talk is a great way kind of to figure out if they have that gift of gab, if they're able to relate to people, if they can talk, you know, in a non-socially awkward way. I feel like, you know, it's the questions behind the questions, like you said, or it's just those first initial impression about the person and their ability to carry on a conversation. And I'm like, is this person going to be a good fit in sales? Because if they can't handle a few simple, how's your day going? What are your plans for this weekend? Like, what do you like to do in your free time? Stuff like that. Just little things like that. There's a lot of little red flags, you know, and that for me, it's the easiest one to identify for sure.
I agree. And I think, Joe, Andrew, you're both very right when you say this is one of those things that there's more of a gut feeling. It's almost an emotional reaction, not a logical one. It's hard to put it into words, but we know it when we feel it. Because again, as we've said, it's kind of that likability factor. Is this person likable? If they are, it's because they're smart enough to know how to be likable. And so I think the result of someone who has smarts is they come off as likable. And it's tough to measure. I don't know that you could put a number on it, but you can definitely feel it when someone's got it versus when they don't. And I think what's great about this is that you see it in just every aspect of who they are, right? And this goes back to in the book, in the fable section, where he talks about, you know, how did they interact with the receptionist? How did they interact with the front desk? Likeable people are likeable by everyone. If it's something that they're too easily turning on or off or putting on for show, you know that it's not necessarily enough or not necessarily genuine. Whereas, you know, someone who is really, truly smart is they're likable to everybody. And likability is a huge factor. You know, we know this is a relationship driven business. And a lot of what keeps us in accounts is they like us. They like seeing us. They like having us around. And eventually, once everything else falls into place and trust has been built and a reputation for success comes along with it, there's going to come that day where the relationship tips and we start selling more based on likability than on the numbers, where I don't have to go in anymore and justify it. I've got to earn that, granted, but you know, that's going to keep us in an account a lot longer than the ability to perform sometimes is just, yeah, I like seeing that guy when he shows up. I like when she comes in the building and is just so happy to be there and all my, you know, wait staff loves this person and that likability can go a long way for sure. And you feel it. You feel it right when you start interacting with someone.
I find it interesting that in this part of the book, he brings up the fact that smart people can use their talents for good or ill, which just, you know, something about that chilled me. Because he says, think about the most dangerous people in history have been noted for being intrapersonally smart. And your mind just jumps to like every serial killer and cult leader. And you think, wow, I mean, there's a reality in that to somebody who's too damn good. I don't know where the balance is on that necessarily. Again, maybe it's just a gut check. But I found it interesting to say, you know, I think it's a really important aspect of how we hire and a really great trait for anyone to have as a team member. But, you know, that tipping point can be subtle, and that's something you'd really have to watch out for.
Yeah, and I think the balance is having the other two characteristics too. You know, he goes into talking about that skillful politician, that, you know, the schmoozy charmer. That's not who we want to hire, but it's someone who has the smarts, but the other two. But you're right. I think this one, it can kind of be hidden a little bit. We could hire serial killers. Thanks, Joe. Thank you. Now in every interview, I'm going to be thinking, is this guy a serial killer?
And now you know why we always interview in pairs. This is an important part of our process. we say it's because we want two perspectives, but really we're keeping the serial killers outnumbered. That's our real purpose in interviewing in teams. No, I could not agree more. I think smart can cover a lot of failings in the other two, right? We see somebody who comes in and they're super likable, and it makes up for the fact that they're not hungry enough or they're not humble enough. And I agree, Suzanne. I think the balance of what happens when someone is too smart, the balance is, are they humble enough and hungry enough to be able to use that smart for good instead of evil? Because I think the ones that are using it for evil are the ones that lack in those other places. If they lack too much in the humble, they are using their smarts to advance themselves at the expense of others. If they lack too much in hungry, they're using their smarts to cover up for the fact that they're just not getting anything done. But I'll tell you, we have seen a lot of people around this place over the years who did not carry their weight, but were really damn likable. And they're, you know, they're like that friend that you've got, that lovable slacker friend that you're like, yeah, he comes over and eats everything out of my fridge and leaves a mess. But he's just so much fun to have at the party that we're going to keep inviting him back. Right. We've seen some very, very likable people survive here a lot longer than they would have had they not been likable. I guess that's the important point, is to say they're failing at humble, they're failing at hungry, they're not doing enough, but you know, we'll drag them around for a long time just because they're a good time. And so it is a danger in smart when they have too much of it at the expense of some other stuff. Nate, you seem to agree on that one.
Yeah. Got a lot of personal experiences with people like that around here. You know, you've seen it. You've also seen how the culture, especially here in this facility, has changed when higher up leadership that wasn't as didn't participate in some of the stuff that we were being first choice to say. They weren't approachable, so then it just went down the line, and then it was just okay to be a jackass, you know. And then now that there's different leaders in those certain areas, you have a lot better atmosphere.
Absolutely. Sanction and competence starts at the top. When we allow not smart people to hang around the organization for too long, it allows everybody else to not have to be smart either, because who's going to hold them accountable? The person at the top isn't smart, doesn't care. No one else down the line is going to be held that way either. So it is a important attribute. So I think one of the things that really gives this model its power is that there is such a power in words. You know, Lencioni even finishes this section by admitting it. None of this is groundbreaking in its parts. And I think, you know, we've talked about a lot that in pieces, this has always been there. It's this unspoken assumption in the five dysfunctions. But words give us power. They give us the ability to articulate something. Therefore, we can understand it better. Therefore, we can replicate it. And I think about that in thinking about Trusted Beer Advisor and our six-pack service standards. You know, for years, Trusted Beer Advisor was this aspirational goal, but the definition was like pornography. We know it when we see it. The six-pack service standards gave us something to focus on. Here are six things you do every account, every time. You do these things, the result is you become a Trusted Beer Advisor. And similarly, I think the language around humble, hungry, smart is so powerful because we've all known what ideal team players look like. We would call them first choice employees. We know what that kind of is, but we've not had this next layer down of articulating the parts that make up that whole. And by having words around humble, hungry, and smart, now we know what it takes to be an ideal player. We can identify those things. So now we know that we are, in fact, selecting people who will be first choice. And we don't have to go so much off of gut instinct because we've taken it down another step to go, no, it's really about these three things. And if we can identify and tie in and find these three things, we know the result is going to be a first choice employee. So I love this section of the book. I think this is obviously the core of why we love this book so much, is it's given us a way to say something that we've all kind of intrinsically known but never really had the ability to put to words that could be turned into action. And now that we have them, I think it's such an important part. So I appreciate you guys helping me break this down. And I think we'll continue on as we go deeper into this model, because there's a lot more places to poke around coming up soon. But for now, understanding the core of humble, hungry, and smart, I think is the most important part of what we take from this book. So thank you to my bookies for helping me make sense of it all. And I will thank them each in turn as I do. Joe, thanks for being here and helping us understand what humble, hungry, and smart is all about.
As always, my pleasure.
Andrew, thank you for being here with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Suzanne, thanks for joining us as you do.
Thanks, Jeff.
Nate, glad to have you with us as well.
Thank you for the invite.
Of course. And Kara, thanks for being here and helping us figure out how to be a little bit smarter.
Thanks, Jeff.
My pleasure. And thank you guys for joining us. We'll be back again next week with another installment of the Brew University Book Club as we dive into the rest of the model.